With
this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. As controversial as it is in some circles, fracking is coming to North Carolina. Permits will apparently be issued sometime this spring. The U.S. has an insatiable appetite for energy, most of which comes from fossil fuels, and the technology that has made fracking possible has also ushered in a game-changing revolution in U.S. energy production. Energy independence is no longer a pipe dream, and that has enormous implications for the economy and for geopolitics. Russell Gold knows a lot about this from a professional perspective. He's an investigative journalist and senior energy reporter for the Wall Street Journal. But he has parents who have a farm in rural Pennsylvania where a few years ago they were presented with an offer by Chesapeake Energy. The company wanted to drill or to lease to drill to frack under their land. His parents agreed. So he has a personal connection to what he describes as a revolution that is transforming the United States. You'll find that description in his book, The Boom, How Fracking Ignited the American Energy Revolution and Changed the World. Russell Gold is in town to speak to the World Affairs Council Charlotte lunch today at noon at the Hilton Center City, and he joins us for the hour. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Also with us in our Spirit Square studio is WFAE's Ben Bradford, who reports on energy for the station and has followed the fracking story as it has been developing here in North Carolina, and he'll share some details, including the fact, I didn't know this until we walked in the room today, that the Mining Commission that used to control this is now called?
The Oil and Gas Commission.
Well, that makes sense, doesn't it?
It does.
Thank you for joining us as well. You have another personal connection to the oil and gas story, unless people think that you are some New Yorker working at the Wall Street Journal. You actually live in Austin, Texas, the state where fracking has been going on for quite a while now. Aside from the revolution that you write about in your book, what's your personal opinion on fracking from a close-up parental perspective and from living in Texas?
Well, I've spent 10 years now, more than 10 years, traveling around reporting from various places where there's a lot of fracking going on, whether it's northern Texas, south Texas, North Dakota, Pennsylvania. And I've seen the good and the bad. And the good clearly is that when it creates jobs, it creates economic opportunity in places. And the bad is that, look, this is an industrial activity. An industrial activity, it's often plopped down right in the middle of people's neighborhoods. And rural areas that are not accustomed to this. So I've seen really both. And I try to take a broader perspective. And the broader perspective essentially is that we in the United States are enormous energy consumers. And for years and years, what we've done is imported that energy, oil, and until a few years ago, we were getting ready to import more and more natural gas. To begin importing natural gas from overseas. And so we use so much energy, and we sort of had exported all the problems associated with energy production overseas. And now that's changed. It's come back, and with fracking, we're essentially turning the United States into a massive energy producer again. And there are incredible opportunities and incredible challenges associated with that.
You know, we've done several programs on fracking, just in general, and also because it's coming here and what it may or may not be doing to the environment where fracking goes on. But it seems to me that this came out of nowhere, and it came quickly. And it, as you point out in your book, it has transformed the world of energy production, supply and demand, in what, less than a decade?
Absolutely, less than a decade. So let me give you an example of North Dakota. In 2008, fracking was basically unknown there. They produced 100,000 barrels a day. Today, they're up to 1.2 million barrels a day. That's more than three members of OPEC. They could apply for membership in OPEC at this point. And that happened in what? Over the course of 6 or 7 years.
And because there are liberals who are against this and conservatives who are in favor of it, it's interesting that you point out in your book that this really is the product of a liberal and a conservative.
Right.
A liberal Texan. Are there liberal Texans?
There are.
They all live in Austin. A liberal Texan and a conservative Duke University graduate.
Absolutely.
Who are these people?
Well, let's start with the liberal Texan. We're talking about George Mitchell. So George Mitchell, a son of immigrants, grew up in Galveston and then later Houston, and created a company called Mitchell Energy. And he was a fascinating character right after World War II in the early 1950s. He's one of the first people. Houston was still full of lots of wildcatters and people who'd go look for oil and gas on a hunch, and you know, they'd use dowser sticks, essentially. I mean, it's all sorts of crazy technology. And he tried to bring in science. He was one of the first to really bring in geology and to try to understand where the oil and gas was. And he finds this area and leases up this area north of Dallas-Fort Worth. And for 30, 40 years is drilling there. And the gas starts to run out. And he starts looking around and said, you know, every time we drill through this shale rock to drill our wells, we get what are called shows. Our instruments tell us there's natural gas there. We know there's gas in this shale. What we don't know is how to get it out, because shale is incredibly thick. It's pretty much any building you go into, shale will be thicker than whatever's there. It's thicker than steel, thicker than cement. It's incredible. So they didn't know how to break it open. And so for years and years, and the fascinating thing about George Mitchell is he was committed to sustainability. He funded the National Academy of Science work on sustainability. He used to have, fell under the sway of Buckminster Fuller and just, you know, was fascinated by that big thinking, this question of planet Earth. You know, how are we going to support the billions of people who live here? And at the same time, he was, he was out there drilling for oil and gas and making quite a lot of money on it. So for years and years, he told his people, look, drill through the shale and see what you can do. See if you can get it to crack open to get oil and gas, starting in 82. And he lost money on well after well after well up there. This was sort of a science experiment he ran. And then in 1998, so 16 years after he began to do this, there's a young engineer, completions engineer up there, and who has this idea that, you know, maybe we could try to frack in a little bit of a different way, use more water, use more pumps. He goes down to the headquarters near Houston, gets permission to do three wells. All three of the wells are failures. He goes back down and says, I want three more wells. And they give him permission for three more. The fourth was a failure. The fifth was an absolute success. He finally cracked the code on it. And it really is the first modern well where the industry figures out how to get gas out of shale. That's the summer of 1998. And from there, it's really off to the races. But Mitchell Energy, they sort of disappear from the picture. They sell themselves off to a company out of Oklahoma City. And what happens then is that as people are beginning to develop shales, first in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and then in Arkansas, this young wildcatter from Oklahoma City named Aubrey McClendon, Duke graduate, begins to look around, and he's got a company up there. A company, frankly, hasn't done all that well, called Chesapeake Energy. But he's very ambitious. There's a great story where he goes into Louisiana, and he's competing against another company. The other company thinks they found something. They lease 100,000 acres. He goes out and leases a million acres, literally a million acres, almost bankrupts the company. And when he seizes upon shale, when he sees what it can do and the oil and gas gas, that can come out of it, he sort of turns up the heat on everything. This was an industry that was willing to drill a little, see how the wells did, then drill a little more, see how the wells did. He just went all in, and he began to lease everything he could. When I say lease, he would go out and strike deals with landowners to drill on their land.
And this is the company that asked your parents.
Eventually, they would come knocking on our doorstep, exactly. It was not enough to be number two. He wanted to be number one in everything. And he really, so both in terms of how he pushed the industry to go faster, he sped up the industry. I mean, it was this industry going 30, 45 miles an hour, and by the time he was done with it, they were going 90 miles an hour. Chesapeake Energy went from being a company that in 2003, when I started reporting on this, I hadn't even heard of as a Wall Street Journal reporter. 5 years later, they were drilling more wells than anyone else in the world. 1,900 wells in 1 year was their peak year. And it just, you know, so Aubrey McClendon, who's still around, he eventually got tossed from Chesapeake Energy, but he created a new company, still very active in Ohio. You know, in some ways, he is the person most responsible for the shale revolution, because he pushed everyone to go faster. And from there, you get the good and the bad. You get the energy boom, but you also get having moved so fast that sometimes the regulators, the landowners, just weren't prepared for it.
And I think that's illustrative of something we've never talked about on this program when we've talked about fracking, and that this is really a story of small players, wildcatters, overturning the status quo, overturning the power of OPEC, overturning the power of ExxonMobil,
right,
and really changing the paradigm of energy in this country and around the world.
It's really amazing that, you know, Exxon, Chevron, I mean, all of the big companies, they will come later. But this whole, the technology, figuring out how to do this, going out, all of it was by these small companies out of Oklahoma City and Houston, and essentially the independents is what they were called.
And Ben Bradford is here, our WFAE energy reporter. I don't know that you can answer this question, and I don't mean to be unfair about this, but I know that they're supposed to be starting to issue permits for this in April. Do you know if the players coming in seeking these permits are small people? Do they have a track record elsewhere, or are they the Exxon Mobils of the world, or do you know?
Well, I think that the question is, will there be people coming in to seek these permits, period?
Yes, because of the price of oil, or because we're not exactly a hotbed of...
For both of those reasons. Okay. So I think that the expectation is that the people who will come in here, first of all, people who want to explore and see what exactly does North Carolina have.
Right.
Because like a lot of places where it's not the sort of epicenter of this, there hasn't been a ton of testing. So the tests that we have are old, and there's thought that there's a relatively small amount of shale formations and shale gas and oil, mostly centered near the Raleigh-Durham-Chapel Hill area, and kind of in this slash from there, kind of southwest.
Mm-hmm.
And so people are going to have to come and explore. But, you know, then there's a real question of, like, you know, if you've now built this thing, will they come? Will people come?
And I've seen several maps that show where these shale beds are on the continental United States, on North America. And there's one at the front of your book. And they're big, big patches of this up through Pennsylvania and Ohio and places like that, up toward New York State, down, of course, in Texas, up in North Dakota. I don't even see a pinpoint dot on the map in North Carolina.
North Carolina sort of caught us all by surprise. I think it sort of appears, it kind of hits the industry radar screen last summer at what's called the NAPE conference, the North American Petroleum Expo down in Houston, when all of a sudden a couple of officials from North Carolina show up and start talking about this shale. I would very much be surprised. Well, I would expect that at first it's really going to be the smaller companies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's interesting, a colleague of mine and I at the Wall Street Journal about a year, year and a half ago, looked at Pennsylvania data and asked, and we essentially looked at all the companies. So there are hundreds of companies that drill in Pennsylvania and said, okay, who gets the most citations? Who's most often? If you're going to drill a well, do you want a big company, a middle size, or a small company doing it in terms of the number of blowouts and citations and spills? And the data was very, very clear. The small companies are generally the worst actors. They are the bad actors. They're the ones who don't quite know how to handle everything. They don't have the expertise. And you do tend to see more spills and environmental problems with it. If you want a well done right, you want to bring in a bigger company that's very experienced at this.
How big a role is the fact that it used to take a long time to drill a traditional oil well and have it produce? It doesn't take very long if you hit a good pocket to frack and get oil and gas out of the ground. It doesn't take long at all. How much of a role does that play in causing problems?
Well, I'm not sure that actually causes problems because the way these companies approach it, you know, you sort of have to ask yourself, do you want to be drilling a well that will take you 6 or 8 months way out in the Gulf of Mexico, or do you want to be drilling on land in a well that you can go down and finish it up in a month?
Russell Gold is the senior energy reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He's written a book about fracking, The Boom, How Fracking Ignited the American Energy Revolution and Changed the World. He's with us for the hour, as is Ben Bradford. We'll talk about North Carolina and its fracking prospects as we go through the hour. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Healthy Home Market, a locally grown natural food store hosting an organic wine and cheese tasting Saturday 1 to 4 p.m. at the Plaza Midwood and Davidson locations. Details at healthyhomemkt.com. And Nexen Pruitt hosting an LCS webinar series focusing on updates in South Carolina and North Carolina employment law on February 11th at noon. Details online at nexenpruitt.com. Tomorrow on this program, we focus on the substance that fuels the South, grits. Grits has a long history. Does it grits has or grits have? But either way, they have a long history in the South. It's a breakfast tradition, and it's now spreading across the country. We'll look at why. We'll look at some recipes. We'll find out from some experts exactly how you should cook and eat this delicacy. And that's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Jordan executes two Iraqi militants after the burning alive of one of its citizens by ISIS. The country's role in the fight against ISIS, reaction in the Muslim world, and the future of the coalition.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about fracking with a guy who knows a lot about it because he's written a book about it called Boom, or The Boom. And he's also a senior energy reporter for the Wall Street Journal, Russell Gold. He's in town under the auspices of the World Affairs Council Charlotte. He speaks today at noon at their lunch. There are still seats available. You can go to our website for more information about that. And Ben Bradford's with us. He's the energy reporter we have here on staff at WFAE News. What's your take on fracking? North Carolina is set up to begin issuing permits for hydraulic fracturing in the spring. Do you support it? Why or why not? You can reach us through Facebook and Twitter and email at WFAE/Charlotte Talks or whatever it is. I can't remember. Okay, let's talk more about this. The infrastructure that puts gasoline in our tanks is enormous and invisible. We don't think about it, and we never really see the gasoline. You point this out in your book, because it goes from the pump into the tank, and unless we have a spill, it's a drop or two. We never see it. How much comes from oil wells in this country versus out of this country today?
Well, if you had asked me that a few years ago, the answer would have been fairly clear, maybe 70% outside of the country. It's now going down. The amount of oil we're bringing in has been dropping year after year. The amount of oil that we're producing here in the United States has been growing. We still import oil. We don't produce as much as we use. But right now, we're probably talking 60, 70% domestic.
And are we getting more gas than oil, natural gas, than oil from these fracking sites? Or
depends where you are. Some areas, Pennsylvania is much more gas-oriented. North Dakota is much more oil-oriented. But we have so much natural gas right now in the United States that we don't know what to do with
and
it all.
One of the byproducts of this I learned from you and never thought about this is that it's allowing American manufacturers to bring manufacturing here because our energy costs are so much lower.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I write in the book about one company where down in Louisiana was a steel plant. A few years ago, they literally dismantled it and moved it down to Trinidad, where they've got a lot of cheap natural gas. They're rebuilding something similar in the same place. You can get cheap energy in the United States. It's almost unthinkable from where we were a few years ago.
So that's a good thing. But then there's the concerns that we hear about all the time from environmentalists and concerned citizens about the environmental impact of this and the fact that why are we putting our money into old fossil fuel technology? If we believe in climate change and we know that we're responsible and that fossil fuels play the biggest role, why aren't we putting our investments in solar and wind? North Carolina is situated, the coast of North Carolina is situated in one of the best wind energy producing places on the planet, and yet we're not talking about putting windmills out there. We have a lot of sunshine in North Carolina, and we are making use of that with the increasing solar use of technology. But is the fact that we have fracking, which is lowering energy costs, slowing progress toward development of solar and wind and other alternative sources of energy?
I think it is slowing it a little bit. But keep in mind that since 2008, the numbers on this just came out, we have tripled the amount of wind and solar in the United States. So since the fracking revolution really sped up and takes off, we've tripled the amount of renewable energy. So to me, it's not... It's very easy to look at this and say, well, it's an either or question. We're either going to invest in fossil fuels or we're going to invest in renewables. The truth of the matter is, for the next 20 or 30 years, we have to invest in both.
We have an oil and gas commission in North Carolina. Do we have an energy commission of some sort that looks at alternatives, that talks about alternatives? I know that there was a push to put some windmills out beyond the coastline, and people said, I don't want to look at that. I want to look at the ocean.
Yeah, there's a energy policy council that is housed in the State Environment Agency, and one of their committees is looking at renewable energy and those sort of things. Certainly not in the same way that we've had for the Oil and Gas Commission, for instance, where these guys were really tasked with, hey, we want to bring fracking here, develop a structure for us to do that. So for, you know, jumping off what Russell said, we've seen the same thing in North Carolina since 2008. There was almost no solar energy in North Carolina in 2008. And today, North Carolina has the third or fourth most, depending on which statistics you're looking at, of any place in the U.S.
One of the problems that any source of energy faces is that no energy is completely clean, even wind power. There was an article in the paper this morning that talks about testing the waters off North Carolina for this. And somebody pointed out that the sonar testing to see where these things should be put, these windmills should be put, could hurt marine life and sea mammals in the area because it hurts them. I mean, so there's nothing completely clean about any of it.
I think in general, when you're looking at it, was sort of, again, jumping off kind of what Russell said earlier, when you look at having an energy infrastructure, you're talking about adding industry. And when you add industry, you're displacing other things.
However, former U.S. Secretary of Energy Stephen Chu says on the blurb on the back cover of your book that some see fracking as a vital bridge to a sustainable energy future. How do we know it's a bridge and not a break?
Well, that's an enormous argument that's going on out there, a controversy out there. Here's how I see it. If you have 5% renewables on your power grid, and you want to get up to 10 or 20 or 30, how do you get there? Well, if you're a place like North Carolina, very heavy onto nuclear power, that's not a technology that – it's a baseload technology. It's not a technology you want to turn on and off. And you need an energy source to complement renewables because sometimes the wind doesn't blow and sometimes it's cloudy and you don't have that much solar. As it turns out, natural gas is the best technology out there, natural gas power, for ramping up and down quickly, for coming on and offline, for running at 20%, 40%, 60%. It's very flexible. So, and I write about this a little, it's really easy to see a future. If you want a low carbon or a lower carbon energy future, it's really easy to see a future in which renewables are balanced by natural gas and possibly nuclear, depending on what part of the country you're in. That's a conversation that we don't really have because, frankly, we don't really have a national or even a state energy policies. We don't often talk about where do we want to be in 10 years and how do we get there.
I've had other guests talk about that. We do not have a national energy policy. Why not? We are so dependent and we use so much of oil and gas to run the economy of the country. Why don't we have a policy?
Because, frankly, we haven't needed one. We depend on the market to provide us with energy. And that's worked. Since the 70s, that's worked just fine. The last time we had an energy policy was in the 1970s when there were disruptions and dislocations. Since then, you know, it's not always as cheap as we want it to be, but every time you pull into a gas station, there's gasoline.
Yeah.
Every time you flip on your lights, you have electricity. So unless there's a problem, you know, so often government will create policy to solve a problem. And in the United States, the energy is there. So what's the problem?
I understand from reading about this in North Carolina, Ben, that we have about – if we have any oil and gas that can be fracked out of the ground, we have about a 5-year supply. Does that make it worthwhile for somebody to come in here and start a fracking operation and 5 years later we're out, so they're going to go someplace else?
You know, that's a good question, and I think that's one of the reasons that you might see smaller players come in, people who kind of want to stake out their own turf. But it also doesn't make a lot of sense for the larger players with energy so cheap to move all of their infrastructure, bring in the specialized equipment and technicians to start up this entire thing when there's plenty of natural gas that they can still get to in the areas where they're already located.
What does it look like? We all know what traditional oil wells look like with the big derrick and when they strike a gusher. It gushes out the top, and then they light the flame on the top to burn off the natural gas. What does it look like, these smaller fracking operations?
Well, there are two stages to it. When you're drilling the well, you're going to – well, three stages, really. When you're drilling the well, you're going to bring in a drilling rig, several stories tall, three, four stories, and that's sort of what people think about. You know, you can see them from a while off, but it's only going to take a couple weeks to drill the well. When you frack the well, you're going to have a flat pad of land, probably about an acre of land, and you're just going to bring in every hundreds of pieces of machinery to store water, to store pumps, chemicals.
Is it loud?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. And in fact, in a lot of urban environments now, you're required to put up sound walls. I mean, sort of think about like a Christo art project where you're wrapping an acre in a two-story sort of canvas wall. But once all that's over, once the well has been fracked and it's in operation, what you're left with is maybe a 10-foot tall series of valves in a fenced off area.
So once the rock has been broken up and the gas and oil can be released because of that process, it just keeps releasing without any further provocation until it runs out?
Essentially, yeah. I mean, at some point, you might have to go in and refrack or re-stimulate the well. But yes, the purpose of fracking is to put a lot of liquid down a well and create this gigantic network of cracks, of fractures. And then what happens is over time, the oil and gas that's in the shale will essentially drip or move out into those cracks and continue coming up the well.
And that's part of the problems, because we've talked about this many, many times. The water that they use is a tremendous amount of water. It may go in clean, but it doesn't come out clean. And there are ways that they deal with that. They either take it out and put it in tanks or reuse it. And then there's the chemicals that they put in. And for some reason, those chemicals are proprietary to every company. And they don't, at least under the law in North Carolina, they will not have to release the information, correct, about what's in those chemicals they put underground.
They can classify it as a trade secret. The state reviews it to say, oh, yeah, we agree this is a trade secret. And then the company gets to hold on to it. And they have to have essentially a way to contact them in case of an emergency, a spill, to get that information. But otherwise, yes, it remains secret.
You're shaking your head no.
Well, that's really surprising, because the direction that most of the other states are heading is in towards disclosure. Even states that have started off with trade secrets now require companies to post onto a website called frackfocus.org exactly what chemicals were used. You know, trade secret, having covered this for many years, I tend to believe that trade secret's just a cover for we're going to charge you a lot of money. We don't want to tell you what's in there. There's no reason that you cannot have a vibrant oil and gas and fracking industry and still also disclose the chemicals.
So this is a major debate here in North Carolina.
And what's driving the secrecy aspect of it?
Well, as a matter of fact, back when it was the Mining and Energy Commission, there was a lot of discussion about what this rule would contain, and they were very close to passing one. I mean, I think that many of the rules around the country allow companies to classify certain ingredients as trade secrets or certain, you know, formulation of those ingredients. So they might have to say, okay, we have these kind of, you know, solvents in there, but they don't need to tell you what the exact percentage is. I know that there's different ways of doing it around the country. In North Carolina, they were very close to passing one that was considered to be on the more stringent end of these rules. And the chairman of the commission at the time, Jim Womack, who's been on this program, got a call from Halliburton. He talks about this very candidly, and they had problems with it. And so they went back to the drawing board to do another one. Ultimately, what happened is the Mining and Energy Commission, which was tasked with doing all the rules, didn't actually pass the rule. The Senate passed its own rule, which is where we get the current one. So they actually overrode it and said, no, we're just going to do this ourselves, the state Senate. And they passed this one that has a little bit more it's a little bit more lax in terms of what companies have to disclose.
The media can sometimes blow things out of proportion and cause people to have fears about certain things that perhaps are overblown. But it is scary, and a picture is worth a thousand words. So it is scary when you turn on 60 Minutes and you see somebody turn their faucet on and put a match under it, and the water ignites in Pennsylvania where fracking is going on. That's very scary.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the norm? Is that something that's really off the charts, obscure? Why would it have happened at all? What are the chances that it can happen? How concerned should we be about things like that?
Well, Great questions, and let me see if I can answer them as best I can. No, it is absolutely not the norm. Most aquifers that are drilled through are not are charged up with methane so that when you turn on your faucet, you light them. In Pennsylvania, where this was going on, and this has been a huge subject to multiple lawsuits, multiple everyone's arguing about this, but here's what I can has figured out over time. You're going in – the industry went into areas to frack specifically because there was gas in that area. So some of the aquifers already had some gas in them because they were sitting on top for thousands and millions of years on top of gas. We don't know what these aquifers were like before the drilling began because no one thought to test them. They just started drilling.
Do they test them now?
No. And they and there's been a push in certain places. Colorado now requires this to do testing beforehand so that you know what you're dealing with. So you have a baseline. But I will say, and I absolutely agree with you, that the image of the flaming faucet has just been seared into the public consciousness. That is really the exception. It has happened in a small number of cases. And you have to remember, we're drilling and fracking 100 wells a day in this country.
New wells.
Absolutely.
Wow. In North Carolina, I know there are rules, I think there are rules in the state about how far away from drinking water sources these wells can be located. But do we really know where the water goes in the aquifer? We don't know every little fissure underground that these waters can seep through, do we?
Well, right. I mean, groundwater flows into into full-on waterways and so forth. So, I mean, certainly you can test those things. In North Carolina, the rule is if it provides drinking water, it's supposed to be a 1,500-foot setback, which I understand is relatively long for these kind of things.
But if it happens to you, if you allow fracking on your property or it's happening on your neighbor's property, even though you said no, and you turn on your water and it's undrinkable or it ignites when you put a match near it, then you're not the exception to the rule anymore. You are the rule. So are there protections in place for people who go through that?
Depending on what states you are, in Pennsylvania, yes, they now have protections. They essentially assume that if your water goes bad and you're within a certain, 500 feet of a well, that the problem's being caused by the driller, and so the driller will have to replace the water. You're absolutely right. If you're in a situation and your home, your water has been impacted, it is, there's no excuse for it, and there's no consolation for it. But without trying to sound like an apologist for the industry, that really is a minor exception of what happens.
On the other, okay, I can't.
Well, I was just going to say that I think that's right. I mean, I think that's the one we hear about the most. Those kind of things. But there are pollution concerns as well. There are absolutely pollution concerns that I'm sure
cancer concerns and things like that.
The main thing that when I talk to people, both from the industry and who do environmental remediation from accidents at these kind of things, or environmental groups. I mean, when you talk about pollution, the main thing that you're talking about is what do you do with the wastewater? That seems to be the big question, right? Because you're having hundreds of trucks worth of water that they're going to have to pump into the ground, and it's going to come back up, and it's going to have these different chemicals in it. And in addition to that, then it can even pick up some elements from being far on the ground. What do you do with it? Where do you store it?
Have we adequately addressed that in our rules and regulations with the Oil and Gas Commission?
Well, it's one of the big topics, and essentially what they've decided is you can't store it underground because of North Carolina's geology. That's caused earthquakes in other states. Here, they're going to be putting them in lined pits, which if anyone's familiar with the coal ash debate we've discussed a lot, they are also controversial.
Earthquakes. We'll talk about that in a second, because that's been happening around the areas where fracking has been occurring. And we're going to find out some more things about this that you perhaps never thought about when we come back. Russell Gold's with us from the Wall Street Journal at Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mecklenburg County Solid Waste. Recycling 1 ton of paper saved 7,000 gallons of water, 3 cubic yards of landfill space, and enough electricity to power a house for about 6 months. WipeoutWaste.com. And Bragg Financial Advisors supporting a celebration for Catawba Lands Conservancy on February 19th. Gardens and green space at the Southern Spring Home and Garden Show. Details at CatawbaLands.org. Jordan has executed two Iraqi militants after the burning alive of one of its citizens by ISIS. The country's role in the fight against ISIS, reaction in the Muslim world, and the future of the coalition, the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation, charlottetalks at WFAE.org will get you to us, and you can search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
It's official. Google's high-speed internet service, Google Fiber, is coming to Charlotte.
That's just one of the stories you heard on Morning Edition. Every day, we have reporters in the field and newsmakers in the studio to put the news in context. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Marshall Terry. We were there for you when the Google Fiber news broke, and we've been following it ever since.
Join us tomorrow for Morning Edition from NPR News.
From 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Russell Gold, senior energy reporter for The Wall Street Journal. His book is called The Boom, How Fracking Ignited the American Energy Revolution and Changed the World. It appears to be fairly balanced and easy to read. So everything you wanted to know about fracking is in this book. Ben Bradford is our energy reporter here at WFAE, and he's providing a North Carolina perspective, as it permits to do this. Impending. That's right.
We're probably looking at a couple months away.
Okay. April or so. Mm-hmm. If fracking is so productive, and it has been, and if it has changed the energy paradigm, and it has, and if it has made us almost completely energy independent in 5 years, which it has, why are Canada and the U.S. virtually the only countries that engage in this activity?
Actually, there's a fairly simple and easy answer for that. The U.S. is very unique around the world, in that the people who own the land tend to also own the mineral rights. So that if a company, as they did with my parents, come to you and say, we want to drill into their land, they're going to have to compensate you for it. You have an incredible incentive, dollars, money. Mm-hmm. If you go almost everywhere else in the world, the government owns the mineral rights. So you have places like in Poland and in China and even in Argentina where you've seen shale exploration, where the governments are struggling to try to figure out, how do we get communities on our side? How do we get communities to sign off and to stop protesting? Because they're not providing the same kind of financial incentive that they are in the United States.
Let's talk more about the environmental impacts of this, because we've talked about water degradation. We haven't talked about the fact that some of these wells release gases into the atmosphere, and in some areas they're the equivalent of what a big city would release with automobile exhaust, and they're out in the middle of nowhere. What about that aspect of it, releasing these chemicals into the atmosphere that cause climate change?
Right. One of the things you need to remember is that fracking happened so quickly that so many of the questions we're dealing with now just weren't considered at the time.
Okay.
Do wells leak methane? That's what you're talking about here. Yeah. Methane leaks. It's a potent greenhouse gas. Do wells leak methane? We're only just getting the science on that now. Now, you could argue, well, we should have done this 5 years ago, and we should have known about it before we started, but we didn't. We're sort of dealing with this now. So the question that I'm often find myself asking as a reporter is, okay, this exists. How do you solve it? And is it solvable? Is it manageable? And it seems to me that wherever they have found leaks, they've been able to isolate them and reduce them. So for instance, going back to Colorado, there was a really interesting agreement between the state government and the three major companies that are drilling out there in Colorado. You now have people going around with infrared cameras in Colorado looking for methane leaks, identifying where it's leaking out. Because it turns out it's not leaking from the entire well. It's typically leaking from a couple different pneumatic switches within the well. And so you fix the switches, and you can reduce 90 to 95% of the methane.
But if we didn't know that 5 years ago, what's going on today that we don't know about? And how can we know everything about any of this? Because it's all under the ground, and we can't see it.
Well, that's the question that's it's not all going on under the ground. A lot of when you're talking about methane leakage, it's happening in the apparatuses on top of the ground. It's happening in the well heads and the compressor stations and whatnot. What is going on under the ground that we often don't know are the wells themselves, and are they leaking, and are they going to be able to withstand 20, 30, 40 years underground with corrosion and salts and whatnot. So there are a lot of questions, but
Are the wells in that, talking about it in that way, any different or substantially different from traditional wells that have been in the ground for hundreds of years.
No, these are the same wells, essentially the same wells.
The other concern is earthquakes, and there have been reports of earthquakes in areas that have been fracked, and some people say it's because of the fracking. And if you're talking about shale being so thick, and suddenly we've been able to go in and break it up to release tiny, tiny pockets of oil and gas, aren't you talking about destabilizing the substructure of the earth?
No, the fracking itself goes on so deep underground, and the cracks are so microscopic that the evidence isn't there that fracking itself causes earthquakes. However, the water that you're bringing out, that you use to frack, you're bringing out this wastewater. When you dispose of it underground in wells, that is causing earthquakes. I mean, in this case, the science is essentially settled. We know that when you're pumping too much water back underground to dispose of it at too high a rate, you will cause earthquake clusters. We've seen it in Oklahoma City, Dallas.
How big are these quakes?
Usually in the twos and the threes. I think we've seen a couple that go up into the fours, enough that you can feel them, but none of them have caused any damage yet.
Do they irrevocably change the I don't know what the vocabulary is, the structure of the earth, so that if in 50 years we want to put a skyscraper on that piece of land, we can't because it's not going to be stable enough to support the structure?
No, I don't think so.
All right. You write that this revolution is transforming the United States, but that accessing this energy requires tens of thousands of new wells, each fracked with enough water to fill several Olympic swimming pools and hundreds of gallons of chemicals. It also requires turning whole counties into industrial zones complete with fleets of trucks, air quality concerns, a disruption of nature, and fear that water aquifers will be poisoned. To your credit, you don't make this sound very good. Where this has been going on, have these fears been realized for the most part?
You know, not completely. I spent a lot of time in the Dallas-Fort Worth area where they've been drilling for well over a decade. And, you know, there are still – this is a suburban area like you'd find anywhere else. The key really is the key that I found is that – the places that have not turned away from it, that have brought it in, said, look, we do want some of the economics, we do want some of the money involved with this, they need to stay engaged, and they need to constantly update their rules because new problems are going to be addressed.
But are they more comfortable with this in the Dallas area and throughout Texas because they have an oil culture?
Absolutely, sure. And that's why if you look in Pennsylvania, which maybe is much like North Carolina, did not really have a very established oil and gas culture and has really struggled with it. They're still having arguments about how do we tax this? How do we regulate this? I mean, those conversations are still going on every day. And who should get control? Should cities be allowed to ban fracking, or does the state have control? I mean, these are questions that are very much unsettled.
And who has rights? If you're next door to a guy who said, yeah, I'll put a well on my property, and you're literally next door and you don't want it, who has the right to say yes or no? Have we settled that in North Carolina?
We have not settled that. That was another one of those big issues that the commission that was creating the rules was considering, and they ended up punting and just said, you know what, the legislature is going to have to decide that. So it's not a law.
How has that been handled elsewhere?
Well, it was a fascinating situation where a congressman had a weekend house outside of Denver and got a call from his in-laws, I believe, who are staying there, saying they're putting up a rig right at the end of your driveway. No one had notified him. It was on his neighbor's property. So, you know, if a congressman, a sitting congressman, and a very wealthy one to boot, can get a rig put up at the end of his driveway without any notification, you know, it sort of goes to show that there are not a lot of protections built in for neighbors.
Wow. And there's also the concerns for infrastructure, for roads around fracking areas. And I know that these big trucks come and go constantly when they start putting these wells in. What provisions have been made in North Carolina for the maintenance of those roads as a result of fracking?
Yeah, that's another thing that the legislature's going to have to consider. The State Department of Transportation just issued a big report about all of this and the costs of it and the thousands of trucks going across and how that can damage the roads. And their recommendation was essentially to have companies put up money for any roads that they're going to use. But nothing's decided.
You know, this state has rejected giving incentives to motion picture companies and television companies to come in here and make films and TV shows. And it's a very clean industry. It doesn't have a lot of pollution concerns. This one does. In areas where states have been open to allowing fracking, have the states benefited? I mean, the oil companies are certainly benefiting. Perhaps the landowners are benefiting. Are the states benefiting?
Yeah, absolutely. You look at a place like North Dakota, it has an incredible budget surplus right now. It doesn't know what to do with all the money. Texas's budget's been very strong the last few years.
Is that because in North Dakota, they have so many people working and paying taxes, and the minimum wage at McDonald's, we are told, is well above what it is anywhere else in the country?
It's job creation, but it's also taxes, severance taxes. States are collecting a lot of money from the production of oil and gas. And, you know, I do want to make a point. You quoted from my book that there are lots of concerns. But in traveling around places where they have begun fracking, if the communities are vigilant and they're holding the industry and government to account, these are not places that have been destroyed. These are not love canals. These are not sort of industrial wastelands. If people are careful and are holding everyone to account, you can have this kind of industrial activity without it destroying the environment.
And here's another thing that you talk about in the book, which I don't believe we've ever talked about in terms of a positive of this, and that is that the oil and gas industry is and we've already said this, is invisible. We don't see any evidence of it except at the gas station, and perhaps when we get our gas bill at the first of the month. But because we have been importers up until this point, we have exported all of the dirty work of oil and gas development. Now that we're allowing this to happen again and we've revolutionized how we get our gas and oil in this country, it's on us to get it right.
It's a huge opportunity to lead the world in saying, okay, what does it mean to have clean fossil fuel production? Can we do it right? If we're going to use oil and natural gas in the kind of volumes that we do, doesn't it make sense that it's incumbent upon us to figure out how to do it right?
Are we doing it right, and are we doing it better than other countries right now with regard? Other countries don't frack, but they are pumping oil. Are we doing it right and better than other countries?
We are almost doing it right. There are still places for improvement. Absolutely. Are we doing it better than other countries? Yes, some countries. I remember when I visited Nigeria a few years ago down the Niger Delta. This is a country that has exported billions and billions of dollars of oil, and the environmental toll, the corruption was just incredible. But at the same time, you go to a place like Europe or even Argentina, they take a very different approach than we do. They essentially, here in the United States, we sort of drill first and then we go around to ask the question, how do we make it safer? How do we improve? Over there, what they're doing is saying, look, you, the industry, need to come to the government and make the case that you're going to be able to do this safely and you're going to be able to do this with minimal impact. And once you make that case to us, show us how you're going to do it, then we'll give you approval. So, it's a different approach. It's certainly not something the United States has embraced, but it works for them in terms of protecting the environment. It doesn't work in terms of generating a lot of economic development.
Let me share some things that have come in from listeners as we've been talking. Brian emails, when you say a bigger company will be better prepared to drill a well, do you mean like BP's well down in the Gulf? Now, you covered the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf. And you say that environmentalists need to stop saying no to everything, while energy companies need to slow down and be serious about responsible drilling. From that spill alone, do we have anything to indicate that these companies take a responsible approach to drilling?
Well, first of all, I want to make abundantly clear that what happened in the Gulf of Mexico and the Deepwater Horizon, the well that was being drilled and how it was being drilled was completely different, sort of night and day from what would happen in North Carolina in a couple months or what happens onshore. Just very different wells. Shale wells are much simpler and easier to handle. What happened with BP in the Gulf of Mexico, and it's a really important story. I mean, it's the largest oil spill ever in the United States. Was that this was a company that was pursuing profits and cutting corners, and we know that. We were able to really get in there and figure out exactly what happened. They pushed too fast. They pushed even when there was very clear that there were dangers involved. And they kept going, and unfortunately, 11 people paid the price with their lives, and the Gulf of Mexico is paying the price with all the environmental damage. But going back to the other point, the data was very clear. If you want a well drilled that's not going to have problems, that's not going to have citations, that's not going to have spills, you want larger companies doing it. They simply have better processes. They're able to do this and more effectively than smaller companies.
And that will not be the case here, as we've learned from Ben Bradford here. Grafton emails, can you ask your guest, he has a couple of questions, why the North Carolina Department of Energy did not mandate the use of totally clean frac fluids? Maybe you can answer this. Clean meaning that all ingredients are FDA approved as well as EPA approved. All the major service companies have these fluids, but we did not mandate their use. Why or why not?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I think that the commission took a lot of time to look at how they do it in other places, and they wanted to make it as friendly to industry to come here as they could, while balancing that against regulations that we have.
Grafton has another question. A frac has no impact on groundwater. Groundwater is contaminated only by poor well construction, whether fracked or not. If the cement is not properly placed, you can have contamination in any well, fracked or not. Austin emails something that many people have said on all of our shows about this. At what point does privatized corporate profit override environmental health? Without the environment, we have nothing.
And I think that's one of the big parts that we do need to touch on, which is just the larger context here. That we talked about this, the way that this relates to climate change. Is a big thing. We've talked about how it is cleaner than coal, for instance. Talked about methane and those kind of things. If you look at, for instance, here in North Carolina, Duke Energy is planning to build 8 new natural gas plants over the next 15 years, yeah. And you look at 50 years in the future, what's the plan? Well, the plan is to still be relying on those plants that we build now. So it is cleaner than some of the sources that we have otherwise, but we're also committing to this for the long term.
You advised your parents when they were presented with an opportunity to have a lease with Chesapeake Energy, and they went ahead and signed the lease.
They did.
And what has been their experience?
Experience has not been a bad one. No environmental damage. There have been some problems we can talk about maybe, but overall they've been cautiously, they remain cautious, but it's been not a bad experience.
You also say the energy companies need to slow down. Any evidence that that might actually happen in 5 seconds or less?
Well, yeah, the price is forcing them to slow down right now.
And that's the other thing we need to get to today. The dropping price of this may not make North Carolina very attractive. Ben Bradford from WFAE News. Russell Gold with the Wall Street Journal, his book, The Boom. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte,